He had a gun at the back of his jeans, right? Like a bloody gangster, right? He was walking up and down like this, right? At the same time, they were putting newspaper on the floor. I was not afraid. I was just so focused, right? The fear comes later, right? I was just so focused. And there's where my blood is going to be. And he's the one who's going to...
Okay. Yeah, no. So you do indeed look like a journalist. And I have just come from Kamakura, which took an hour in the humid, sweaty Tokyo train system.
Yeah.
But this is what we do, man. We travel from place to place and we meet people. We have conversations.
Yeah.
We'll just sort of ease into it. This isn't an interrogation. The police are not waiting outside, though we may get to that part of the conversation. Really keen to just talk about your work, what you've been doing, and kind of what motivates you. So if that's all right, I'll read a little introduction and then we'll get into it.
All right. Okay. Yeah, shoot.
Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. My guest today is Johan Nylander, an award-winning author and freelance correspondent from Sweden. His work covering Asia has been published by CNN, National Geographic Travel, and Forbes. Johan wrote The Wolf Economy Awakens, Mongolia's Fight for Democracy and a Green Digital Future. He also wrote The Epic Split, Why Made in China is Going Out of Style. Johan, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure. Yeah, thank you so much.
You know, I sat down to plan out what we were going to talk about. And of course, the topics that come to mind first are the technological rise of communist China, the decline of Hong Kong, and the emergence of regional powers in places like Mongolia. But something that struck me as profound amongst all of that was your Instagram. You have these photos of running marathons in places like Pyongyang, North Korea, Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, and of course the Hong Kong Marathon. What is it about running that helps you make sense of the world?
Well, that's a good question. Like a lot of people, I'm kind of new to running, right? I just started a few years ago for like health reasons. Physical and mental health reasons. And a lot of people ask me, because I do this like crazy long distance runs, right? And people ask me, oh, you must love running. I said, no, I hate running. Like, I really hate it. But if I don't run, I go a bit cuckoo upstairs. It's a way to find a balance in life, right? To find some, almost like meditation.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to think about anything else when you're trying to, you know, just keep going, right?
Yeah, I mean, the first 5 kilometers can be a bit rough, like the first 8 kilometers be a bit rough. But after 8-10 kilometers, you come into this zone of like your mind, the voices in your mind go silent, right? It's this state of meditation almost.
Do you find though with your work, and we'll get to that in a minute, but with your work, you are always thinking about things and you're always sort of running over ideas in your head usually?
Yes.
Okay.
I cannot switch off. This is my like a strength and a problem. Like my mind is always like buzzing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good thing because I think of ideas about stories. Like I talk to myself a lot when I'm out walking on the street, like preparing interviews. Right, or going through interviews, like I'm trying to write my stories with my feet. Right, I write often my stories when I'm out walking. Then I type them down with my fingers. But I do have an issue. I find it difficult to switch off my mind. So running is one of the ways to get some mental stability.
You know, I think I really understand what you're talking about, Johan. I often go for walks. And those, I think there's a big difference between the walking mode and the running mode. Because when you're walking, yeah, you can talk to yourself and you can think things through. And I do this quite often, you know, like a Sunday evening, I'll go for a long walk and think about everything and kind of have this dialogue with what it is I'm working on, you know, my life's work. But when you're running, you know, and you're breathing heavily, it's a lot harder to do that, right? And for me, I mean, the thing I do actually to get away from it is I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. which is like, man, you can't really think when someone's trying to choke you, or you know, you're wrestling on the ground. Like you have to be present.
Yeah.
So it's kind of this idea of presence, right?
Yeah.
And not being stuck in the future or the past.
Yeah. And also when you do this longer distance, when you, well, I talked when you passed like 5, 8, 10 kilometers, but when you pass 30, 35 kilometers, you're in a very, very different state of mind. Then it's like overcoming something that is bigger than you. Like you're in so much pain, like your whole body says like, stop it, don't do it.
Don't do it.
Yeah. And the other part of your mind says like, what did you say?
Yeah.
What did you just say? Come on, you can do it. You can do it.
Yeah.
And you're all alone there. Like no one is there to help you.
Yeah.
And it's, I think you, I learn a lot from that about myself and, yeah.
Well, no, that's profound. And I think, well, again, with your journalism, which we'll get to, just that, that center of control or that kind of place of action that exists to propel you to somewhere like North Korea, to then go and have run a marathon in North Korea, but you know, actually to get out of the comfort zone and push yourself there is really quite profound. So I want to talk a little bit about your work then. So you previously lived in Hong Kong, and in 2017 you published the Amazon best-selling book Shenzhen Superstars: How China's Smartest City is Challenging Silicon Valley. Now a lot of people might not know this, but Shenzhen and Hong Kong are pretty close by. Indeed, that larger Pearl River Delta is effectively the world's factory for electronics. But you wrote this book 8 years ago, and I am struck by the optimism. It's a relatively short book. It's got a very positive outlook. There's this promise of growth in a city without a history, only a future. I mean, you quote an American veteran of Silicon Valley who said, Shenzhen has an energy of growth. It's not just in technology. It's this idea that whoever you are, whatever you're into, you can come to China and especially Shenzhen and do it.
Yeah.
Has your view changed on this?
Well, it's a quite, yeah, like the book is very short. Like you read it in 1 or 2 hours. Maybe that's why it became so popular. It's an overall quite positive outlook of the city. Like I'm not, you know, a cheerleader for, you know, a dictatorship, like quite the opposite. But the people I meet in South China around the Pearl River Delta, right, they say that, which is down south in China, they say like the mountains are high and the emperor is far away, which means that what's happening in Beijing, what the communist regime is doing, telling people to do, it doesn't always, you know, translate what people down in the Pearl River Delta are doing, right? It was the first experiment zone of China, the first place back in the 70s, 80s, where people got the chance to choose their own future, right? To work what they wanted with, they got the chance to make money, to start companies. And so I started traveling there, so I moved. So I still live in Hong Kong today, but I live between Hong Kong and here in Tokyo, right? But I moved to Hong Kong like 14 years ago. And back then, people in Hong Kong, they used to warn me about Shenzhen. Like they said, like, oh, it's really terrible. It's polluted. Like you cross the border, you get lung cancer. They will rob you. It's really bad, right? So naturally, I went there, right? And I realized like, wow, there's really something happening here, right? Something happening that people in Hong Kong, which is like right next to Shenzhen, don't know about, the people in the world don't know about, is that this city is about to become like the world's leading or among the world's leading technology hubs.
Yeah.
I mean, you have these tech startups, small tech startups, big tech startups. And today, some of the world's most prominent technology companies come from there.
Yeah, well, you quote, you talk about BYD, who are famous for the electric vehicles, and I think you talk about them having made 100,000 vehicles in the book when you wrote it. And I think I looked it up last year, they had put out 4.7 million electric vehicles. So in that time, it's gone from, you know, this still incredible number to the just overwhelming number of vehicles produced. This kind of superstructure of not just one city, but you've got the entire region sort of effectively become this cluster of cities. And I mean, it's really quite incredible, but it's also, you know, this current geopolitical moment we're in, people can look at that and be quite concerned that maybe there's a centralization and that, right? And so I just wondered whether that political element plays into the way you look at it, or whether you still think it, Shenzhen has its own kind of technological future outside of politics, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, under President Xi Jinping in China, it's difficult to have any kind of independence. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate his influence over day-to-day life of how people live their lives and how people conduct business. But if your company is in any kind of strategic industries, like if it's connecting to AI, Internet of Things, anything to do with national security, surveillance, anything with dual use, like military civil use, yeah, the government will have their fingers in your business. And this is something that can support individual companies. You can get funding, you can get contracts. It's also something that can, like, naturally hold everything back. And there is a political element in everything, right? We have a tech war. People talk about trade war between United States and China. I think that technology war, technology conflict is much more interesting to talk about, much more important. Mm-hmm. I mean, who will dominate technology in the future? Right? Mm. And it doesn't really matter who is inventing something. The most important is who is developing it, right? It doesn't matter who invented the gun. The most important, who's got the most guns today, right? And China are very good at catching up with everything. They do it with, I mean, they used to do it by copycatting, right? And now it's by research and development and innovation. Yeah. And everything's got a political or military element in today's technology. And this is something that affects the global supply chains and technology chains, right? So it's a very important question, and we don't know how this is going to play out, right? But
are you familiar with the work of Frank Dakota, who's a Hong Kong-based academic, Dutch academic?
Yeah, of course. He's very famous.
Yeah, so he's Frank Dakota is a Hong Kong-based Dutch academic and China critic, and he has strong thoughts on the Chinese Communist Party. In particular, he's very critical of the communist propaganda that has made its way into the English-speaking world. And, you know, I have heard my own friends say things such as, you know, China has been able to raise millions of people out of poverty. It has these clean, high-tech cities like Shenzhen. It's putting the West to shame. If only we could plan better, maybe we would be like that. And according to Dakota, this is the work of propaganda, and it seeks to attribute everything good to the party and everything bad to the West, in a sense. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very interesting question, and I think the way, when I was growing up, right, I'm a child of the Cold War. Right, you are the good guy.
You're the good guy.
Always, no, you have the good guy. No, I'm from Sweden. We are like always floating in between somewhere. No, you have the good guy and you have the bad guy, and the bad guy is always failing. Right, it was Russia, and then you had like North Korea, and there was like totalitarian, dystopian dictatorships. Right, but now we have modern China, which is also like authoritarian. Dictatorship, but they're very successful, right? So the propaganda really works. At the same time, you have a lot of people in the West, in the United States, who doesn't believe in the democratic principles. They don't believe in the media. They are like complaining, trash talking everything. And then you see China, and it on the surface it looks like it looks good, right? You have the high speed trains, you have the skyscrapers. The Communist Party, they always claim that they lifted 800 million people out of poverty. You can also twist it and say that they stopped oppressing people. They allowed 800,000 people to lift themselves out of poverty, right? So they take the credit for the good things and they blame the bad things on, you know, the foreign influencers like the Black Hand. Yeah. But, I mean, I spend a lot of time in China and I can see the good, I can see the bad, right? There's been a tremendous, I mean, no country on the planet in history have had a quicker, stronger, more powerful development. Like I spoke to a Swedish academic who spent some time in early 80s in a small town in northwest China, right? And he explained how people there, they were like undernourished children, like running on the street, hardly any clothes on, like absolute poverty. He said he was traveling with his backpack, and he probably had more possessions, more things in that backpack than a household had in total, right? And from that like absolute poverty to becoming the world's biggest economy in terms of purchase power and skyscrapers and technology companies, and also feeling in China among the people that what we are doing is right and correct, and our time has come.
Right? Our time has come.
Time has come. We've been in the shadow. We've been like humiliated. We've been in trouble for 100 years, but now we are back. But with that said, when you cross the border from Hong Kong is this special economic, a special administrative part of China. We still have freedoms and institutions and media, free internet that people don't have in mainland China, right? So I live in a society with much, much higher degree of freedom than they have in mainland China, although that is being eroded. But when I cross the border into mainland China, in the first second, you feel the surveillance. You see the cameras everywhere, police presence everywhere. Everywhere you look, there's a police looking at you. And it's freaky. I think if you live in China, if you live there every day, maybe you don't see it. You get acclimatized. Like you get so used to it. But even when I came from North Korea back into China, it's freaky, the level of surveillance, right?
In China,
yeah. I mean, naturally, I grew up in a free and open social liberal society, right? So, and this is quite the opposite. Mm. So when you look at China on one side, it's very impressive. The West can learn a lot from China. Like, we have so much to learn from what they do in China, and there's so much to be afraid of.
Yeah. So this is interesting to me because, again, I'm in between these worlds. I've been to China a couple of times, nothing substantial, if I'm honest, but certainly it was quite awe-inspiring. And, you know, I live here in Tokyo, and I kind of missed out on the boom years, you know, the 1970s, 1980s. Tokyo was a very different place, and you know, I meet people who lived through that. And today it's this kind of shadow of growth. You know, things are very calm and slow moving now. Whereas in the 70s, it was really pumping. And there's this idea, which I want to run past you, that when things are good, you know, maybe it's okay. But really the challenge with a political system is when things are not going so good. And obviously Japan has been in 30 years of decline, yet it's still an incredibly safe, clean, liberal place in many regards. And I wonder what your thoughts are on, you know, as maybe there's some economic turmoil, you know, what does that mean for what you've experienced in China? Like, how do you see that maybe playing out?
Well, I think first, if you look at Japan, it's very interesting when you look from a country from inside or from outside. Like when I talk to local people here, they are like not very happy about the economy. They feel like all small companies are in the shadows of these big giants, and as an individual, there's nothing I can do. There's a lack of, you know, how you look at the future, right? But when you look from the outside of Japan, it's been 30 years of, it's been no big growth, but I mean, the lights are still on. It's a thriving society. It's maybe the safest country in the world, among the safest countries in the world. The big companies are still very successful. I think Japan is like tackling a lot of the problems in a quite good way. So I think, again, you can see the good and the bad.
Yeah, right? I guess that what I'm getting at, man, is... so I was in the library just next door reading a 1976 press review of basically what happened in that year. And that was the year Mao Zedong died. And there's this quote that really stuck with me, that a revolution is not a dinner party. It's not an essay. It's not embroidery. It is the systematic overthrow of one class by another. And it's really quite striking when you look back at these photos from 1976, from you know, the old days of China. You know, it really was a bloody revolution. Millions of people were murdered. Millions of people starved to death. And now we've arrived at this place where it is, you know, maybe it looks like it's prosperous, but still, you know, how do you sue the government? How do you have these systems in place that enable individuals to thrive and own private property in a way that is respected at all levels of the state? There's these kind of systematic things that only seem to be issues when they become issues. And Japan has inherited a lot of this stuff after World War II, the separation of powers. And I realized, man, it's actually quite an important thing. Like, I mean, it sounds a bit blasé to say, but yeah, it is important. And you don't get that in communist China. And I don't know, man, it seems to be something that maybe they're sleepwalking into, this kind of system.
I mean, separation of power, and I think I've learned more about democracy over the last few years living in Hong Kong, when I see how Hong Kong has never been a democracy, but it's based on democratic principles. Like, the pillars of society, the institutions were based on democratic principles. And after the umbrella movement about 10 years ago, and then the 2019 pro-democracy protests, and then this national security law that was implemented 5 years ago, after that, all local pro-democracy media are gone, right? A lot of, more than a dozen journalists are in prison. A lot of the most famous pro-democracy politicians and activists are famous. Many of them I interviewed like many, many, many times, or they are in exile. And there's no opposition in the parliament anymore. Like in the legislative council, there's no real opposition anymore. And what happens when you have a government, even if it's a local government, with no opposition, you have no checks and balance. You have no debate. You have no arguing, right?
Yeah.
Which means that any kind of decisions will go through. Like, it doesn't matter how dumb they are, right? And I mean, they say that freedom of speech, freedom of media, democracies can be noisy, right? But then you have the silence of authoritarianism, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, which one do you prefer? And this is what you see in China, even more today under Xi Jinping, also in Hong Kong. It's not a failed system. I wouldn't say it's a failed system, but it's a very different kind of system.
Yeah, and I think that's part of it, to be honest, part of the work I'm trying to do with this show is to have these conversations and understand what is going on, because there is, I mean, I'm pretty open about my distaste for the legacy media and some of their structural biases about things. But actually, I mean, we are going through a sea change politically, economically. There's a lot of things happening. And I do come back to Frank Dakota's comments about that propaganda that's making its way out there, because I'll be honest, I'm from New Zealand. I mean, the infrastructure is not doing too well, man. Like, the country is just unable to get anything done. And you see people's comments around the way China's been able to roll out these EVs and these high-speed rails and stuff. And it's like, well, New Zealand's never known totalitarianism, ever. And so it's like, it kind of has this allure. And I'm reminded a lot of the early Soviet Union, which had, you know, this kind of image of putting the first man in space and these kind of technological wonders and this kind of equality. And it seems like we're forgetting these lessons of the past when we look at China for any kind of guidance on technology, even at the expense of what these core fundamentals are. But at the same time, I mean, we can't ignore it. As you say, there's a lot to learn. And so, I mean, it's an open-ended thing. I don't expect you to have the answers for me, but I just wanted to say I think it's a very interesting thing.
And I mean, in China, it's always been, I mean, Chinese people are not dumb. I mean, they know that it's state-controlled media. They know that, like, Big Brother controls everything. They know that, and they go on with their lives.
Pragmatic,
right. Almost as free as we are in the rest of the world. There's some things that don't touch this. Right, and it's been this social contract in China that's been very successful, and this is something that all China watchers are well aware of and been talking, debating, and it's this social contract that you can make as much money as you want. Like you can, since the 80s, maybe you can send your kids to universities in America, you can make as much money, you can own property, you become rich, you do whatever you want, but don't touch politics, right? Politics is for the Communist Party, right? So you can do whatever you want, but we take care of politics. You can make money, we take care of politics. And this social contract has been quite successful, right? People from like poverty, they could move into nice apartments, get a washing machine, buy a car, send your kids to university. The kids come back, they get a good job at Tencent or Huawei or BYD, right? Make a good career. And but what's happening now is that the economy in China is really changing, like dramatically. I've been covering Chinese politics for a long time, like a decade and a half. And often you hear people saying that the crash is coming, but it never comes, right? I remember New York Times had a headline about China saying like, China is the economy that fails to fail, right? But I've never seen like the question marks and like the dark clouds over China's economy so strong as now, right? You have the property crisis, which is the prices are down by some good 30% since the peak. And most of the households, most of their money is locked up in property. So property wealth, boom, down the basement. You have consumption down the basement. You see like Chinese tourists when they come to Tokyo or Hong Kong, they don't spend money anymore. Like they might buy an ice cream, but they don't go to Louis Vuitton anymore. Right, they live in cheap hotels, they don't live in the five-star hotels anymore. Mm. And there's a lack of belief in the future among young people in China. Like, and one, so this contract, this social contract between the people and the government is cracking, right? I don't know what's going to happen, but I talked to a lot of people who say that their trust in the government is not as good as it was maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So there's something happening.
And you mentioned this kind of idea of China watching, and this is quite interesting because coming back to Frank Dakota, he talks about it in his book, China After Mao. He says like he was never interested in China watching and trying to read the tea leaves like people would with, say, the Kremlin as well. That he preferred to look into history to get answers, because I mean it's a closed system, you know. There's not much to watch in terms of the political world. But in addition to that, many years ago, James Palmer wrote for Foreign Policy magazine, "We foreigners don't know China, nor, however, do the Chinese, not even the government." And there's this kind of idea that maybe, despite all their surveillance systems, they don't know what the fuck's going on. And they're trying to stop unrest and being very day-to-day and very tactical as opposed to some grand vision. And it's us foreigners who seem to think that there's maybe a grand plan in place, right?
Yeah, it's good. Palmer is one of my favorites. Like, okay. I love his writing.
Yeah.
Like, he's tremendously... It was a good... He's got a nice pen, as we say in Sweden. Like, he's a good writer. No, I mean, we do our best... Right, I think especially journalists, we do our best to try to understand. Like sometimes you write the day to day, the new numbers coming in, export numbers, GDP numbers, and you don't really know are they true or not, right? But we still write them.
Hallucinations. Yeah.
Hallucinations. I mean, yeah, never underestimate hallucinations. Mm. But what I'm trying to do is that I look at the numbers, so I don't really look much at history. I know the history, but I try to maybe look more towards now and what view does people have on the future? Like, how does people feel today? What decisions are they making? Because decisions you make today are based on your belief in what is going to happen, right? Mm. And so I try to travel quite much, not just in China, but the whole region, and sit down and talk to people. Like, how do they feel about their children's education? How do you feel about your job? How do you feel about work security? And from there you can get like some understanding about the feeling of the situation, yeah. Right? And it's very hard to know, right? But It's very difficult to know, but I think we all do our best, like the academics, the historians, the economists, the geopolitical analysts, the journalists like me, people who travel in the country, the diplomats who also have, China watches in a way. And I think it's just a group effort, right? You can't just read one article and say that that article will explain everything. Yeah. It's an ongoing research.
Well, right. I think the other thing that's interesting, I was back in New Zealand for a few years, and my best friends were all Chinese people living in Wellington, in the capital, and I felt more at home with that than I did in many ways with local Kiwis. It's sort of having a hot pot, having dumplings, having a party at my place. I mean that really responded to me, and I mean that's one of the reasons I'm here in Asia. I've felt that attraction, and I've become very conscious that. This isn't some monolithic thing. I think it is clearly the Chinese people and then the Communist Party of China. And I've spent quite a bit of time in Taiwan, which is, in many ways, the opposite story.
Yeah.
Incredibly liberal, progressive, and that's still same familial Chinese culture. Mm. Yet there is also an incredible passion for law, rule of law, and democracy. And I don't know, man. It seems as if really the critique does need to be focused on what is happening with the communists. And this is where I look at Frank Dakota's work, and I think, yeah, man, it feels as if it's just a matter of time for the communist system to really, finish itself. It's not even necessarily an external force, perhaps.
Yeah. I live in Hong Kong, bro.
Okay.
We have a national security law.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah. You can't say anymore. It's okay. I can cut this out if you need.
No, it's fine. No, here's the thing. I speak to a lot of people in mainland China. I mean, the trust in the government is changed dramatically. Like I hear from business people, I've heard this for quite some time, especially after the crackdown on Jack Ma and Alibaba and so on some years ago. During COVID, a lot of people started to question this like authoritarian like top-down system, and now when the economy is going quite not very good, I even hear politicians say like, we don't know what's going on anymore. But I don't think the Communist Party is going to crack. I don't think the Communist Party is going to crack. If it's going to be any change, it's going to be within the system, right? I think the old traditional view was that one group takes down the other. I think if it's ever going to be in a major shift, it's going to be a shift within the system.
Okay. No, that's okay. Sorry, yeah. I put you on the spot there.
No, it's fine. I mean, this is what we do. I'm a journalist too.
So I'm from New Zealand, a country similar in some ways to Sweden. I also... like Sweden, we inherited this history of liberalism, Christianity, and enlightened political discourse, many other things. And, given your background and the time you've spent in Asia, how have you been able to situate those things which are so natural for you and I with this life you now have in Asia?
Well, I think the most important, especially my life... and my journalism, I think sometimes you separate them, but no, they go more hand in hand, right? I lived a long time. I've learned a lot about this part of the world. I really feel at home, like in Hong Kong, Tokyo. This mentality, these values people have here. But when I do my reporting, I do believe in democratic system. I believe in freedom of speech, freedom of the press. Everybody's equals. Right equals responsibilities, right? They have to go hand in hand. There are a lot of societies, there are a lot of parts of societies here that I might not agree with, but in my writing, it's not about what I agree with or not, right? I interview people and I allow them to speak their mind, right? Mm-hmm. People I agree with, people I don't agree with, to have like a balanced view on things, right? And that's very important. Then of course, it's challenging to write for a European, American, or Western audience, because often the level of knowledge is not that high.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know how many times I met people coming into Hong Kong and they go, oh, konnichiwa. Like, oh, I thought we were in Japan. Oh, man, right?
Get some sushi, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, more than once, I met people who fly into Hong Kong and think it's going to be a Japanese society. Or a friend of mine in Sweden, like when we were moving to Hong Kong, she said, oh, Hong Kong, I love Hong Kong. It's a great place. Oh, you've been to Hong Kong? No, but I've been to Thailand. Like, what? So the challenge for me when I write about this part of the world is that I get to know and understand the culture here, but I still need to write from a perspective where the people don't know much, right? So it's a bit challenging sometimes.
So looping this back to this kind of economic situation and this outlook for China, there's sort of the three no-go zones, which are money, politics, and arguably God. And I wonder, you know, you grew up in Gothenburg, Sweden. Sweden is a country of the Lutheran State Church, long history of Protestant Christianity. I know, or I've heard from friends and seen this idea that there's an increasing amount of people in China who are actually becoming Christian and seeking to spread the gospel. Is this something that you're, just given your cultural background, that you've been able to apply this lens of Protestant Christianity to your work exploring China?
Mm. I mean, first of all, I wouldn't call Sweden a Christian country. It's quite non-religious, right?
Recent phenomena, or?
No, I mean, when I grew up, we read from the Bible during Christmas, right? We went to church before the summer holiday, and so on, and it was part of the culture. But I think religious studies were called Christian studies when I was growing up. But it's atheist country, I would say. Like, you marry in church, not to marry in front of God, but because it's just the thing you do.
Okay. Right?
So it's never been. I think Christianity is a very, very non-issue in Sweden.
Okay.
Right. I mean, it's more that, like, Islam is taking a bigger part of society today, right? That's another big topic, right? But when you look at China, this is very interesting. Christianity, not just in China, but in Japan and especially South Korea. Like, South Korea, these Christian groups are tremendously influential in politics, right? Especially the conservative politicians, right? Who tend to end up in prison. And in China, there are some movements in Christianity, but it's very dangerous. Yeah. Right? You have the churches in China, you have a lot of underground churches. There's been a crackdown under Xi Jinping. It was easier before to be open Christian in China. Today it's less so, right? I don't have it confirmed, but I've read stories that In some churches, they have taken down the Ten Commandments and replaced them with the thoughts of Xi Jinping in the churches.
Yeah.
I'm sorry for laughing, but it's kind of... And naturally, there's been crackdown on these churches. They demolish the buildings, right? Also on the mosques, right? It's a very difficult situation. You have Buddhism and to some degree in China, but no, it's the Communist Party, right, that you should look up to.
Well, I think that's what I'm getting at here, because when times are tough, it seems as if a transcendent power. People need that. They have that God-shaped hole in their heart, and I think this is interesting to me, because again, I have heard stories of, you know, these people operating underground missions, underground churches, and increasingly there's a church in Tokyo that talks about the number of Chinese converts into Christianity outnumbers all other nationalities. And this is, I think, a very interesting piece of information, because it says there's some kind of desire for some kind of bigger redemption than you could get from something like a political party, and whether ultimately this is, you know, relevant here.
When I spent time in China, like, I never see anything connected to Christianity.
Okay.
Like, never. I'm trying to think back, right? I've been traveling in Sanya, Xinjiang, I guess in mosques. Churches? Have I ever seen any churches? Maybe I have.
There's a few in Shanghai.
There might be. Maybe because I'm European, it doesn't stand out for my eye.
Right?
Yeah. I never heard anyone talking about it. But I think also you had communist China was so dominant for so long time. And then after the economical opening up in the 80s, money became the god. Right, money is driving everything in China. Money is the god, right? And I think maybe now, when you don't, you can't, people are sliding back into poverty again. The economic security is fading, right? And maybe, as you say, when times are hard, right? You're grasping for something to hold on to, right? So I mean, from a logic point of view, it would make sense that people might turn to these kind of corners.
What disconnect, Johan, do you see between English-speaking commentators and audiences and the reality on the ground in China and perhaps North Korea as well?
Well, I think we have a view in the West that we are the best, right?
It is true, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Of course. No, but I mean, I think wherever you're from, you think that my system is a bit better, right? I mean, in Sweden, we think we're a bit better than the people in Denmark.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The Danish think they're a bit better than the Dutch, right? No, but I think especially people in the United States, they look at China from a superior, what they think is a superior perspective, right? And when you are in China, you realize they're doing things quite well here, right? They are, in terms of economy, in terms of technology, they're doing really well. So there's a mismatch sometimes, right? I still hear people saying that China is poor, Chinese people are dumb, it's just copycat, the factories are dirty. It's super modern, right? And people are quite well off. So there's a mismatch of the reality. People look at Vietnam and still think of, children bombed with napalm, right? You go to Ho Chi Minh City and it's just skyscrapers everywhere. Like Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur is, skyscrapers everywhere. Southeast Asia is just booming in terms of economy. Those are the most important consumer markets in the world, right? And a lot of people in the West don't know that. Right, so a lot of things happening in China, Southeast Asia, that people have no idea of. Right, there's an ignorance, right, a superiority complex, right, that is not always correlating with reality. Right, I think that's important that you read about what's happening in Asia, but also come traveling.
Yeah, see it for yourself.
And not just traveling to the beaches and go to Bangkok and smoke weed and go to the beaches, but actually try to speak to local people. Right, had to integrate a bit with the people who live there. Right,
with North Korea in particular, your time there, because that's a little bit maybe more closed off than China, and people's public the public perception, is the hermit kingdom. I mean, tell me about your experience with North Korea.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's very important. So I've been to North Korea two times. Right, first I was there for CNN. I was writing for CNN International. My second time in North Korea is very important to point out that I was not there in capacity as a journalist, right? I was there, two, three months ago. It was a marathon, the Pyongyang Marathon. I was there as an athlete, right? Amateur athlete. I did not report anything from there. It's just really important to point this out, right? But it's really fascinating. When you go to North Korea, and again, this is also important to point out, I'm not a cheerleader for totalitarian dictatorships, right? I do think that democracies are a tad better societies than totalitarian dictatorships. But when you go there and you talk to people, you realize that the North Korean people it's just like people everywhere. They wake up in the morning, they have their breakfast, they go to work, they want the best for their families. they work hard to have a better tomorrow, right? Again, it's been 10 years since my last trip to North Korea. And when we came to Pyongyang now, we were the first foreigners in 5 years who's been there, right? So it's been really isolated. And first of all, the guides I speak with, like we have the guides and we have the people from the Ministry of Sport, and they were so happy to see us, right? Because they haven't had any contact with the outside world, right? They don't have an internet. They can't watch news. They can't watch Netflix, right? So their connection with outside world is often when tourists come, so they can have a chat with outside people. And now we could sit in the bar and have a drink and talk about everything, right? So they were very happy to see outside people, yeah, just a glimpse into the outside world, right? Mm-hmm. And when you spend time in North Korea, I mean, of course, again, it's the regime. It is one thing. When you talk to people, it's one thing. But there's a lot of development also there. There are skyscrapers and tall buildings everywhere in Pyongyang, like modern buildings. And over the last 5 years, there are huge new residential areas and buildings, 80-floor buildings, right? Pyongyang looks like a mix of Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia, like old Soviet-style architecture, mixed with Kuala Lumpur, like modern buildings shooting up everywhere. It's a funny hybrid. Mm. There are Toyotas and BMW and Mercedes on the streets everywhere. A lot of Chinese BYD that are normally electrical cars, but here they're not electrical. All the taxis are BYD. It's important also to point out that what you see in downtown Pyongyang might not translate to what's happening on the countryside. Like the capital is the most prominent. It's more developed than the rest of the country, right?
Have you been able to see any of the rest of the country?
I've been traveling to some parts of South Pyongyang, and I've been up to northern part of North Korea, but naturally they don't show me the poverty, right? I mean, it follows the same logic if you go on a press tour with the authorities from Thailand, right? They're not going to take you to the slum areas of Bangkok, right? They're going to show you the nice, like the banyan tree, you know, spa and resort, right? They're going to take you to the flashy places. They don't take you to the dirty underbelly of society. Mm. But in North Korea, naturally, they want to show us the best things. Mm. And it was fascinating to see that everybody, or most people, have mobile phones, right? They were all, you see commuters on the buses going to work with their eyes glued on their smartphones, right? So they don't have internet, but they have an intranet, like internal internet, like a closed off mm-hmm. internet. Mm-hmm. So they are texting each other. They have like the North Korean WhatsApp, right? They have North Korean Netflix, like they can watch movies from North Korea, from China, from Russia. On television, they had this Indian Bollywood movies, right? Which is quite funny, yeah. Dubbed to Korean. They can order Uber or the taxi. They can follow Premier League, right? So the people from the Ministry of Sport, they had wild arguments with my son. My son is 18 years old.
He came with you, right?
Yeah. Yes. My son, 18 years old. He was the youngest on the trip. So he's a Manchester United fan. Our closest guy that we got to know from the Ministry of Sport, she was a Liverpool fan, and they had like wild arguments. I was happy to stay out.
Yeah.
They all knew about Donald Trump. They follow American politics, right? Everybody knows everything about Donald Trump. No one remembers Biden. You know, he's just forgotten. The other guy, they call him. And Chinese politics and so on. I mean, people are not dumb. They have very limited insight into the rest of the world, but there are information, you know, coming in via other channels.
Well, let me put it this way. I think, again, I reflect on New Zealand, and there's this apathy, disinterest in the deeper questions related to political systems or economics. But what we have in our favour is that because of the checks and balances, the system still enables them to have the freedom to do those things and ask those questions if they desire.
Mm.
And so I can ask questions and I can question the legitimacy of the state. Mm. I can look at the foundational documents of the country of New Zealand and critique it openly, publicly, no problem. Mm. And that's something that not everyone is able to do. It is almost like an anointed task for intellectuals, academics, journalists, lawyers. And these are the exact kinds of questions that are very hard to ask in North Korea, China, and increasingly in Hong Kong.
Mm.
And we get into this place where, very much like 1984, you can watch the football,
mm.
or you can enjoy a beer with some mm. friends, and you can enjoy the music and the TV. But you cannot fundamentally question the legitimacy or the mandate of the state or how we even got to where we are. And I think this is almost the biggest concern I have on this whole project with the podcast is like, well, what if we forget what it means to ask the question?
Yeah, it's very important. Like, again, I've learned more about democracy over the last few years in Hong Kong when I see how it's being dismantled. Like, when checks and balances are disappearing, when there's no opposition, there's no debate in the parliament, right? I think when I grew up, born in the 1970s, like, Sweden was rich, stable, and there were no big problems, right? Well, of course, all these problems in societies, but I was kind of born with a silver spoon in my mouth, right?
A political silver spoon, right?
Political silver spoon. We didn't have to fight for much, like, take it for granted. Yeah. Like, things are changing now, I think, in the West. But when I moved to Hong Kong, right, and now I see, like, wow, how quickly it's being eroded and how quickly there are topics that you can't really talk about in Hong Kong because of your personal safety. And also how difficult during a dinner to raise some topics, right? And it's very damaging for society.
Well, you start self-censoring.
Self-censoring. I mean, all censorship starts with self-censoring, right? And this really disturbs me when I see in the West this, like, cancel culture that you can't talk about this, you can't talk about that. You have to be worried so you don't, you know, make people feel emotional about this or that, or, like, hurt anyone's feelings. And for God's sake, man, of course we have to hurt each other's feelings. I mean, don't by deliberate, but, like, we have to have open debates, right? We have to agree that we can't agree on everything. Right. I mean, I listen to your arguments. I don't have to agree, but I'm willing to learn and listen from you. And it's so damaging for everybody in society when you can't have open debates anymore.
Well, I think I got this memory. So I mentioned, you know, I had a lot of Chinese friends back in New Zealand, and we, you know, have hot pot party at my house. And I remember we got quite drunk once, and we were doing karaoke at my house, and I thought it would be funny to throw the next song on and go to the Chinese Communist National Anthem.
Mm.
And the air just sucked out of the room. And one of the girls said, hey, sorry, you can't. She just clammed up. And it was as if I had just triggered this repressed memory of her childhood growing up.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Or something. And I remember that quite clearly because we were all having a really good time listening to the pop music, singing along. And when I put that song on, it was like, no, I had sort of stepped over the line.
But she was from China.
Yeah, yeah.
Grew up in China. Yeah. And you did it as a joke.
I was like, hey, you know, like, we're just, like, mucking around. Yeah. But, and she had been in New Zealand for years. Yeah. And it was like, I realized, you know, because there's nothing like that really in New Zealand that would stop someone in their tracks.
Yeah. But I think that's a bit of a different issue that probably triggers some childhood memories or trauma or something more than it's politically incorrect.
Oh, so that's right? What I'm getting at is it's like fundamentally she had, I'm just sort of projecting here maybe, but I felt like maybe she had integrated that political system so deeply that to kind of point at it when she's here in New Zealand in a free country, it was like the PTSD of totalitarianism, like, reared its head, you know?
PTSD of totalitarianism, wow. It's like a book title.
Speaking of this, though, just to come back as well, I remember last time we talked, you mentioned actually a lot of North Korean or Korean refugees came to Sweden when you were growing up. Is that Tell me about that. So after the Korean War, they grew up like children.
Not North Korean, South Korean.
South Korean refugees, sorry.
No, they were like adopted.
Adopted?
Yeah.
From
South Korea.
After the war, so they had lost parents.
Yeah? Especially back in the 70s.
Yeah.
No, but Sweden's history with both North and South Korea is fascinating.
Okay, tell me.
So Sweden, I mean, Sweden was quite socialist when I was growing up.
Yes.
Right? So after the war, right, so North Korea had a lot of backing from Russia, right, from Soviet Union. So the economy in North Korea did quite well. Right, under Kim Il-sung, Sweden thought that North Korea is going to be the new Japan of Asia. Right, so Swedish companies start to invest heavy.
Yeah.
So like Volvo sold like thousands of cars, and like ABB was rolling out power transmitters. Right, and like all the Swedish industrial companies investing. Right, while South Korea was falling deeper and deeper into poverty, right? It became among the poorest countries in the whole world, right? And the problem with North Korea was that they bought like thousands of cars from Volvo, but they never paid for them.
I see.
Yeah. So still today, North Korea's got this massive debt to Sweden.
Yeah.
And but also Sweden opened an embassy back in the 70s in Pyongyang. And I think Sweden was the only Western country for some good 25 years.
Interesting.
With an embassy in North Korea. And still today, when United States are having diplomatic... The United States don't have official diplomatic relationships with North Korea. So they go via Sweden's embassy.
Interesting.
The Sweden's ambassador is speaking on behalf... I don't know the right terminology, but speaking on behalf of the Americans.
Right? I see.
And also Sweden and Switzerland are still guarding the border between North and South Korea, the demilitarization zone, Sweden and Switzerland. And during the war, the Sweden's Red Cross had field hospitals everywhere in Korea, helping people.
Did that affect your, when you went to North Korea, did that relationship affect you as being a Swedish citizen?
Yeah. So Sweden's got a very good reputation, both in North and South.
I see.
When I'm in South Korea, when people hear I'm from Sweden, especially old people, they come up and say thank you for your support over the war. So Sweden has like a quite unique relationship both with North and South. Right?
That's fascinating.
And I think, I mean, I don't have to support North Korea's political system, but I think it's good to have open diplomatic dialogues.
Of course, right? Communicate, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned actually in an article for the Foreign Correspondents Club of Japan that you have indeed been arrested by the police in China before, but you were very scant on the details. Can you tell me more about that situation?
Oh, shit, really? That was quite bad. Some 10 years ago, I was traveling in Xinjiang, like it's the province in the northwest where the Muslim Uyghur population live. There's been a lot of reporting on oppression on the Muslim population, on there have been reports on human rights violations and so on, re-education camps, and like true horrors. Like even the United Nations have been writing about this. So, yeah, I was going on holiday, and where do I go on holiday? Like, I don't go to a beach in Thailand, I go to the desert in Xinjiang. No, so I was traveling around there for a few weeks, and again, I met a lot of very nice people, both Han Chinese, you know, the Chinese people, and Muslim Uyghurs, right? I got invited to weddings, I got invited to people's houses, and so on. And I've been traveling to the south of the Taklamakan Desert, right? One of the biggest deserts in the world, right? To the south of the Taklamakan Desert, right? And to this small village, like sandy village, like you had sand everywhere. And we were having dinner, and suddenly, like, we saw sirens, police coming. They stormed in the house. They pushed me up against the wall. They had guns. They stripped me of my belongings, my passport, everything, and I got arrested, right, along with my Muslim friends, right. And they put me in an interrogation room in a police station. And it took a long time before my Chinese then was better than it is today, but it's very, very bad. My Chinese is very bad. But I could say I'm from Hong Kong, I'm a tourist, I work as a journalist. I don't want to lie, right? I don't want to lie to them, but I'm a journalist in Hong Kong, I'm a tourist here, right? I had been writing for CNN from there. I've been writing for Swedish media, right? But I don't... I do my writing when I'm back in Hong Kong, right? It's what most journalists do, right? And this is my way of working from after speaking with China's embassy in Stockholm also. Like, you travel in China, then you write when you're back in Hong Kong, right? So that is what they say you can do. Anyway, I was sitting in that room, and an interpreter came. They were playing good cop, bad cop for a long time. One was really aggressive. One was trying to, you know, button me up. Right? By the door, next to the door, was a young boy. Like, he was probably 18, 19, but he looked like 14 with an automatic rifle. Like, looking really nervous. Right? I was sitting on a small stool. Then this guy came in. This he looked like a thug, like a jeans, t-shirt, short hair, no uniform. He had a gun at the back of his jeans, right, like a bloody gangster, right. He was walking up and down like this, right. At the same time, they were putting newspaper on the floor, right. And I was not afraid. I was just so focused. Right, the fear comes later, right? I was just so focused on, there's where my blood is going to be, and he's the one who's going to hit me, right? And I know since before, like, you want to get eye contact. The person who's going to interrogate you, the people who's going to torture you, you try to get eye contact. If you get eye contact, you can get some empathy, right? When you meet someone with eyes, you have a bond, right? So I was trying to get eye contact with this guy, but not once did he look down on me. And I realized, oh boy, this guy is professional. Damn. And he was walking up and down. But nothing ever happened, right? I think he was there to intimidate me, right? The interpreter came. I was there for like many, many hours. They found my stories eventually in my computer, right? The story I had been writing is that I had been to a town called Karamai in the northwest. It's an oil town, Karamai. Outside town, you have this like nodding donkeys everywhere, like sucking up oil from. It's a really rich town. Poor people, rich town. And I've been going to the hospitals there. And outside the hospitals, they had these big signs, posters, and if you have Muslim clothes, like if you cover your hair, or if you have like a big beard as the men, you're not allowed in, right? So it's pure apartheid. If you're a Muslim woman wearing Muslim clothes and you need to give birth, they won't let you in. If you need an operation, they won't let you in, right? You need to strip yourself of your clothes, right? Take your headscarf off, right? Humiliating, right? That was the story I wrote. And they found the story and they were furious. They were furious. Why did you write bad things about China? And I said, what do you mean bad things? Like, I'm not the one doing this. You are the one doing it. And they got even more angry. And I realized I should stop talking now. But the thing was that they had also arrested my Muslim friends. They were in the other rooms. And I knew from these weeks in Xinjiang, I know that they are not safe. Like, people are disappearing. People are disappearing. People told me how their cousins, uncles just were gone, just disappeared, right? They don't know where, if they were locked up, if they're killed, what happened, right? The oppression of the Muslim people is immense. So I knew that I'm a foreigner. I have a Swedish passport. I was writing for CNN, Swedish media. I'll be fine. Right, they might rough me up, they might throw me behind bars, a few weeks, a few days, something. I'll be at the end of the day, I'll be fine. But my Muslim friends, they might not. So my number one priority, like, get them out. I'll be fine, right? But get them out. That's my number one priority. So after they found these stories, I said, yeah, I wrote these stories. I give you my word as a gentleman that they will not be published. You get my friends out. I give you my word as a gentleman that these stories will be spiked. I will not publish them. But you get my friends out. And these police officers, yeah, I don't know if what I said made any difference or not, right? But I tried, right? And a few hours later, like, I was there for, like, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 hours. In the middle of the night, they let me out. And my Muslim friends were already out. And and they told me to leave town. It's like in a Clint Eastwood movie, like, you leave town, you're not welcome back.
Right? Yeah.
So, I met my friend outside the police station, and she was furious. She, like, you have to write this, you have to publish it. I said, I cannot, right? But she said, I don't care if I die. I don't care if I die, you have to publish it, right? It's my decision, right, as a journalist. I cannot take that as my responsibility to put her in danger, right? She was already in danger enough. Anyway, the next day I left town. I had to take a bus, 18, 20 hours through the Taklamakan Desert to Urumqi, the capital. I remember this during mid of the night in the bus. I was just waiting for, like, the blue light to come up, like a police car to come up, stop us, take me out of the bus, take me out in the desert and disappear me. But I came to Urumqi. I took the flight to Shenzhen. From Shenzhen, I took the train down to Hong Kong. I took the ferry to the island in Hong Kong, Lam Island, where I live. My friend came down to the ferry pier to pick me up. We went to his house. He gave me a beer. I opened the beer. I took a first sip, and then my whole body started shaking, and the tears came, right? Like this. Fuck, I get goosebumps now. So all along, just kept my guard up. Like stay focused. Don't be afraid. Be focused, right? But then when I got the first sip of beer, it's all like, bah, the big crush came, wow, right? And what happened after, like the day after, my friend got beaten up by the police. My other friend got beaten up by the police. Some of the friends around who I been around, they lost their jobs. Right? I can't get in contact with them anymore now. I don't know if they are, what happened to them. Right? It's very hard to talk about, actually. I worry very much about them. I think of them, it's been 10 years, right? I did write to go there. I did try to write about this. I worry. I don't know if they are alive or not. Right?
Yeah.
Let's hope for the best for them.
Yeah. And thank you for sharing that, Johan. I mean, I know it's a very personal story for you. Were you able to get support from CNN or from the embassy or anyone while you were in China, or were you on your own in a sense?
Yeah, I got a lot of good support. I spoke to my editors at CNN and more for the news agency, the TT news agency I was a stringer for in Sweden. I was sending texts to them once every second hour to make sure that we had ongoing conversation. And then afterwards we have long discussions, and both my editors at CNN, I was a freelancer, I was not employed, right? It's important. Everything I did was on my own initiatives, right? My own decisions, right? But I got very, very good, afterwards, we spoke a lot.
Yeah.
It's fine. I mean, that's life, right?
Yeah. I appreciate you sharing that, because I think for a lot of people, New Zealand, Japan, Sweden, that feeling that you've just described, which I can see, you know, it's coming back into your body, this kind of this feeling of almost helplessness, of being this object at the whim of some system which you have no power over whatsoever. That's not something that we are very familiar with in the democratic world. And I think it can be almost a body shock, a mind shock to see that and to feel it, even if it's only for a few days or a few hours. But it's like, wow, I didn't realize how vulnerable I was.
Yeah.
And maybe this is something we've forgotten in the West.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate my own story. Like, people have spent days, weeks, months, years, decades, right, locked up in this system, right? The Swedish citizen, Gui Minhai, for example, he's been there like many, many years now, locked up in prison in China, right? So I don't want to exaggerate my own story. It was just a few hours, but could have been worse. But it's freaky, like when you suddenly are stripped of all your freedoms, right? And I hadn't done anything, right? I hadn't broken any laws, right? And no one told me why I was there. There were no charges. There were no phone calls. I couldn't contact anyone. Right.
If someone, you described some, I think, some very interesting insight though, when you are in a situation like that, maintaining eye contact with the person on the other side, is there anything else you've picked up over the years for dealing with an interrogation or something of that nature?
I think try to stay calm, to be focused, think, like, don't start. I mean, we all react differently in extreme situations, right? You know, some panic, some freeze up, right? Some start screaming, some you know, start crying, right? I think I'm lucky that in those situations I get super focused, like super focused. I think what to say, what not to say. Like, don't lie, but maybe don't say everything, right? Because you don't want to be caught lying, right? But also you don't want to overshare. And also, like, you can still be friendly.
Can you get a laugh in? Did you manage?
Yeah, we were laughing a lot in that interrogation room.
Oh, really?
Some really crazy things happened.
Yeah. This
oh man! So when I was sitting there, like I told you, they were threatening to beat me up, and this guy with like the rifle and everything, and this suddenly, this guy came in, and he had medals, and he was a Uyghur Muslim. With like police uniform, with medals, and you could see he just had a shower. He was smelling of shampoo and perfume, and this was like in the middle of the night, like 1 or 2 a.m. And he came in, and like started to speak French. Like, I don't speak French, but bonjour, monsieur, like whatever you say in the middle of the night. Yeah. And I was like, hello, ni hao. And he started to speak French with me, and I'm sorry, I don't speak French. And he said, but. And he tried again, like Fred Astaire walking in. I said, I don't speak French. But he said, but you're from Sweden. And I said, yeah, but we don't speak French in Sweden. And naturally all the police, they were like, hey, what is going on here? And he said, well, your royal family, they are French, aren't they? And I said, yeah, like the Bernadotte family, they are French, but that's like 300-400 years ago. They also speak Swedish now, right? And he, so you don't speak French? No. And he got really disappointed. And this is a small desert village. And he was like the only guy in the village speaking French. Like the only Francophile in the village. And for the first time, someone came to the village that he could practice his French with. And he was so disappointed, right? And then they were going through my camera, right, for the photographs. Right, so it's nothing, you know, incriminating or anything bad I've done. And they came to my photographs from Hong Kong, and they asked, is it okay if we look at Hong Kong? And I thought, yeah, it's just in my favor, they can see my family, they can see my life in Hong Kong. And they came to one photograph of two friends of mine, a woman from Philippines, she's playing piano, and my friend from the UK, he's on the guitar, and he's got this like messy kind of blonde yellowish hair, right? They are on stage. And this Francophile guy, he looked at the photograph and like, wow, is that Kurt Cobain? And I said, yeah, it's my friend Darren. Like, yeah, that's Kurt Cobain. And he's like, wow, you know Kurt Cobain? And I'm like, yeah. And then he said, oh, I love European music. And then he started to sing Rammstein. Ram, du hast mich, du ha-. He started to sing Rammstein, thinking, like mixing up Nirvana, European music, in a fucking interrogation room with guns pointing at my head. That was so surreal. That was so surreal. Like, even now when I think about it, it sounds like...
So your relationship with Kurt Cobain, in a sense, maybe this saved your ass, man. Like, you know, this guy came in with all his medals and...
Yeah, I mean, I think... I mean, they're doing their job, yeah. Right? I don't have to be an asshole. Of course, I need to be... like stand my ground and think of what I'm saying and so on. But I think my style is like, if they can see the person within, right? Because they are afraid, okay, I'm a journalist. Maybe they thought I was there to spread, you know, propaganda about democracy, spread like an uprising. Because the week I came, a lot of people were killed. Like 99 people were killed during that first week when I came, right? In shootouts between Muslims and Chinese police. Sort
of high tension.
Yeah, high tension. Like you could feel it everywhere, like very tense. So naturally, maybe they thought that, maybe they didn't care I'm a journalist. I think they were afraid that I was there to, you know, to whip up some, you know, emotions about democracy or try to influence people there, right? Mm. They don't really care about journalists much in China. Honestly, they don't really care. But they care about if people try to be, you know, activists, right? That's a very different story.
Yeah, right? I understand.
So it was really surreal in that room, right? So I think the more they get to know me, like the person, maybe it can benefit me.
Right? Yeah. No, that's incredible. And thank you for sharing that. The final thing I just wanted to cover, Johan, talking about technology, coming back to your work exploring Shenzhen, your writing about technology in China, can you tell me what you know or what you see when it comes to Bitcoin, please?
Bitcoin in everywhere, or
as it relates to your own knowledge, but also in relation to China?
Well, I mean, China's got a very interesting history with Bitcoin. I mean, it used to dominate everything, all the mining used to be in Bitcoin. I've seen photographs from these mining villages. It's like street up, street town, and it's just, what's it called? Like servers, right? It looks like a village, right? And also they were trading and speculating, accounting for like 95% of global trade in Bitcoin. And then the government said no, and it just fell off the cliff. And China wants to create its own e-currency now. Like I don't really know what's happening there. I think people are still talking about it a lot.
In terms of the ability of something like Bitcoin, though, to be a currency that isn't controlled by the government, how does that factor into your worldview?
Well, I mean, I've been writing about economy for a long time, and I think having a central bank is quite important for stability, okay, to fight inflation, and to have a currency stability. And actually, the strength of Bitcoin is that you don't have any control mechanism, and the backside is that you don't have any control mechanism, right? So it makes it, you can use it for speculation. It's very difficult today to use it for as a payment system, because one day it is up, next day it's down, and then maybe you can't pay your rent, right? Because your rent is in normal currencies, right? Okay, stablecoin is a different story. I think most people I speak to in Hong Kong, when they invest in Bitcoin or crypto, they do it via ETFs, right? It's easier on the apps and so on. I think the most important is the technology behind it, right? I think it's like the gold rush in America. Like the people making money during the gold rush were not the one finding the goal. It was about selling the equipment, mm-hmm. like the furs, the boots, the what called all the equipment,
the shovels,
use, the shovels, right?
Interesting.
And maybe it's the same with Bitcoin, that it's the people doing the blockchain technology and so on. That is the most important, the blockchain technology. And I am far from an expert.
No. Right? Understood. I mean, I guess I do ask in the capacity of everything we've talked about today. For me, and maybe this is something we can talk about afterwards even further, but I do think there is a revolutionary potential with Bitcoin that I'm always keen to test with people who have actually been in difficult situations like yourself. I tend to think that the ability to have money that's outside of the state, especially in a totalitarian system, that's like, man, that's got some power, and it's kind of hard to model exactly how that manifests, I think. But regardless, it feels to me as if it's got some kind of power.
Yeah, and in China, everything you buy via Alipay or WeChat Pay is monitored somehow, right? And in Hong Kong, a lot of people prefer cash, not to be monitored.
Yeah,
I prefer. We have Octopus in Hong Kong. It is a payment system for the metro, for 7-Eleven, for like day to day convenience buy, and it's anonymous. Right, and cash anonymous. Also here in Tokyo, a lot of I still think for a lot of people cash is king if you don't want governments or companies to track everything you do. So it's an important discussion.
Well, I think that could be a discussion for another day. Keen to explore that maybe further with you at a later date, but certainly today you've shared some incredible stories. I feel very privileged to hear that. If people want to follow your work, your writing, your various projects, where can you send them? Where would you like them to go?
Well, I have a new book coming out soon. It's about Thai boxing, Muay Thai. It's a biography about a good friend of mine, a former world champion in Thai boxing. It's a heartbreaking and inspiring story, how to overcome trauma with the help of combat sport, right? It got nothing to do with Bitcoin or politics, right? I think the best way is to follow me on LinkedIn, Johan Nylander, or Instagram is Johan Hong Kong. Well, I have a question for you. All these episodes you've done on your podcast, like you interviewed a lot of people on very interesting questions. Yeah. What are the most important things that you have learned, like sitting down with people like this? How has your worldview changed, maybe?
I think I realized how important discussion is and the commonality that we all have as brothers and sisters of the human race. And that sounds a bit simple, but really there's all kinds of people out there. And I think in a hyper mediated world, it's easy to create stereotypes and images of someone who we think are maybe our enemies, or we're told that they're our enemies, but actually we all have something in common. And that commonality, I think, is really important to hold on to and to build bridges and to put in the proof of work to step away from the political desire to create categories and to push people away. I think out of all my conversations, I realize that's what's happening. And unfortunately, a lot of it is happening through economics, through the media. And so I'm kind of looking at how we can go back the other way, I guess. And a lot of the conversations are taking me there. So, I mean, that's, probably one of the bigger things I've learned,
No, it's very good. And it's easy to fall into this stereotyping. I mean, we all do it. And we have to, because to simplify our view of the world, right? But as a journalist, it's deadly, right? It's very important to know that we all come from maybe different chances in life. Some come from poverty, some comes from richness, but I think at the end of the day we all have the same goal, the same ambitions going forward, right? It's very important, exactly what you said. I think that also this why this kind of podcasts, this kind of discussions are so important.
I think getting away from the day-to-day blows of what you might read in a newspaper and actually getting back to the context and I think the importance of going long format, letting people open up. And talking with people on different sides, you know, left, right, of this political spectrum, different countries, different religions, just hear what they have to say, and with nuance and understanding, meet them in the middle, you know. So, but Johan, I do appreciate your time, though, seriously. Right. And I've got a book here from Bangkok for you, which we'll talk about, and maybe we'll go grab some lunch or something. But we might wrap it up there. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks, man. It's my pleasure.
Cool.
All right. Cheers.
I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.